This is a slightly edited version of a presentation that was given at the San Diego chapter of the organization End of Life Choices. Please have a little patience because the audio quality does improve after the first few minutes. The introduction is by the president of that organization, Mr. Ken Fauzel.
The Schiavo case brought a lot of attention to end-of-life issues in general, and particularly in withdrawal of the feeding tube. And we're very fortunate today to have an expert in that area, and that is our featured speaker today. And I'm going to introduce him and let him tell you about what he knows and what he proposes about refusal of food and fluids at the end of life. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Stan Turman. He's an MD and a PhD, and he's a very well-noted psychiatrist and is highly respected in this field and in this particular subject matter particularly. And he's written a number of books, and he has...
Well, this is Mother's Day, and I would like to start off by honoring my mother and my mother's mother, although I never met my mother's mother. And my mother told me that she was not afraid of death, but she was afraid of dying. And she had a wish. And the good news is that her wish came true, and the bad news is that it came true prematurely. My mother died very rapidly, without any pain. That was her wish. But she died at the age of 63. Okay. My mother's mother died very slowly, and that's probably where my mother's opinions and wishes came from. She died of uremia, an end stage of renal failure. They had no dialysis.
Died very slowly, and that's probably where my mother's opinions and wishes came from. So it took my grandmother 7 years to die, and it was a dying process which was accompanied by a lot of discomfort, a lot of itching that was nonstop from what I was told. Okay. I want to give some thanks to Michael Evans, who I met in the organization whose name preceded End of Life Choices, same organization, the Hemlock Society. And Michael and I have become close friends and colleagues, and Michael keeps me from making terrible mistakes in my writing. He provokes me, stimulates me to think about things I might otherwise have thought about. And a new colleague, Christina Allen, who can stand up, who's one of the newest attorneys in San Diego. And another colleague is Ellen McCarthy, who's community liaison director. And best of all is my wife. Would you stand up? Beth Victoria. Okay. And I see a number of friends as well. And my daughter, Lauren. Okay. All right. I'm a researcher, and I love to take surveys. So the first survey is... what do you want to die of? Okay? And don't laugh. It's a very important survey. How many would die? And I want you to, and my researchers, I want to, for statistical accuracy, Christina and Ellen, you will take the numbers down. Okay. How many people here would like to die of a heart disease? Raise your hand. Okay. Come up. Okay. All right. How many people would like to die of stroke? Very few. How many people would like to die of acts of violence, including terrorism and accidents?
If it's instantaneous without suffering,
okay,
I'll go right.
Okay, well, we have, there's Michael provoking me again. I love it. And how many of you would like to die of end-stage renal disease or, nobody. How about infections? That was a really one of the number ones a century ago. Okay. Well, I guess you're all going to die of dementia then. Okay. And most of you did not raise your hand. Okay. The next survey is how many have heard that if Terry Schiavo had only had a living will and in writing, and had only designated a person to be her legal proxy in writing, then those 7 years of litigation could have been avoided. How many have heard that? Please raise your hand. All right, let's reverse it. How many has not heard it? No, oh, just about two people have not heard that. Okay, now, how many believe that this is true? Raise your hand again. About half as many. Okay. Well, it turns out to be not true. And let me very briefly go through the arguments. If I were the attorney arguing for the parents of Karen Schiavo, and she still did have a written living will and designation of proxy. She said that she wanted to be not attached to machines if she was in a permanent vegetative state. But she's not in a permanent vegetative state. And Florida law does not permit the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment unless the patient is in a permanent vegetative state. Oh yeah, Terry signed a document that named her husband Michael as her designated legal proxy. But of course, at that point, in 1989, they were newlyweds, and Michael has since moved on in his life, has another woman, has two children by her, and his decision is a play with conflict of interest. And maybe it's monetary, maybe it's not, but it's obvious that he would be a freer man if she were not around. Oh yeah, Terry signed a document that she would not like her life to be prolonged indefinitely under certain conditions. And even if she is in a permanent vegetative state, you know, she was brought up Catholic, and she signed these declarations in 1989. And in March 2004, Pope John Paul II issued an allocution which said that to withdraw food and fluid is euthanasia by omission. So we're not going to say that that's a durable wish on behalf of Terry Schiavo that we should review it given her religious preferences. And lastly, Terry's parents argue through their attorney that Michael's not the only one who has an interest in Terry Schiavo, but they have a relational interest. And it may not be the same priority as a spousal interest, but it's still relevant to the constitutionally protected right to live. Did I get that right? Sort of. Okay. All right. So those arguments may not have worked, but that's not the question. The point is that to delay is to deny, and delays had effectively denied the prolongation, the honoring of last wishes, and have prolonged the life of many people. And Terry Schiavo had Terry's Law Number 1 in the state of Florida declared unconstitutional, which kept her alive for about 15 months, and then Terry's Law Number 2 in Congress, which kept her alive for another few weeks. Okay, what basically do we fear? And I would like to get some feedback from you if you want to add to this list or revise it in any way. If our brains are intact, we fear being forced to endure prolonged pain and suffering when we have no hope for recovery. And if our brains are so devastated by trauma or dementia that we are not aware and cannot respond, we fear being forced to exist in a state of indignity. And after recent court cases, I think we need to add these additional fears. Our living wills may fail. The writing may be too specific to apply to the terminal condition that we end up in, or they may be so vague that it will cause a prolonged argument over their interpretation. Or our document may be impossible to find, just when our doctors must make a critical decision. Or our future new doctors may deliberately choose to ignore what we wrote if they decide that other medical factors are more important. Our designated proxies may let us down, despite their best efforts. They may not be available to defend our own illness or death, or they may love us too much to make tough decisions when that time comes. Or they may not be well enough informed or strong enough to meet the awesome challenges to be successful as they try to advocate our wishes. And our living wills and designated proxies may be deliberately sabotaged by people in power who do not know us, who care about our last wishes, but who are instead motivated by their own political, religious, or legal agendas, or even by physicians who may unconsciously impose their own personal, moral, or religious values on us. So, if our living wills can fail, and if our designated surrogates or proxies can let us down, and if others may wield their power, what can we do? And that's the subject, basically, in general, of this talk and of my book. And in the handouts, you have a description of the book in large and small size, and a card, a handout on a political football named Terry Schiavo, and 14 questions that are very challenging that the book attempts to answer. And if I don't cover some of those in the main lecture, you can ask some of them afterwards, or you can come up and see me personally afterwards. And then finally, there's the pink evaluation form, my secretary's favorite color. And we appreciate you filling this out as well. Okay. How does the voluntary refusal of food and fluid differ from refusing other life-sustaining treatments? Several ways. The first is that it has to overcome the hurdle of being cultural. There are many cultures, religions, traditions where the ingestion of food or water or wine is part of ceremonies, where the giving of nutrients is considered to be a benefit. That people have to make a paradigm shift that for terminal patients, for years, thousands of them, millions of them, people actually have been dying by not eating and drinking. And there is in my book a review of all the major religions in terms of what their views of voluntary refusal of food and fluid is. And the Christians say, well, this is very much an act of love to give someone food and fluid. Buddhists and a smaller religion, which I recently learned about, Jainism, think that there is no more spiritual way to die than to meditate as you are in your final fast. And if you think about it, the Christian and the Jewish religions also promote fasting. Maybe that was really, originally, kind of a preparation for the final fasting. A second factor about the voluntary refusal of food and fluid is its quality of finality. One of the very famous first legal cases that provided the case law about so that we know what we can do at the end of life in terms of our choices was that of Karen Quinlan, who was supported in life by a respirator, by a ventilator. And when it was discontinued, to her doctor's surprise, she continued to breathe. When people depend upon food and fluid through a tube, and that's discontinued, it's final. There's no way around that. A third factor is the controversy that concerns whether the administration of food and fluid is ordinary care, basic care that any human being would want or require, or whether it's medical treatment. Because if it is medical treatment, as stated in your handout, and as brought down by the case of Nancy Cruzan in 1990 by the Supreme Court, any competent adult may refuse any treatment, even if that treatment intentionally hastens dying. Question is food and water treatment? Well, maybe it is if it's going in through a tube, but maybe it also is if you have to strap down a person who is so severely demented that he doesn't realize or she doesn't realize that you want to do good and he's fighting or she's fighting you in order to force feed by spoon. And by the way, the other issue that the Nancy Cruzan U.S. Supreme Court established was that patients who are incompetent have the same rights as those who are competent, the only difference being that their decisions must be made through their legally designated proxy. And Professor Edward Sunshine, one of the smaller universities in Florida, said about Terry Schiavo, another moral perspective would see Terry Schiavo's medical condition as lethal because her brain damage was preventing her from eating and drinking. And we'll discuss that a little bit more. A final factor that distinguishes voluntarily refusing food and fluid from other life-sustaining treatments is that the individual need not be terminal.